The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Happy New Year! This is Rohit Bhargava, author of Non-Obvious 2018, How to Predict Trends and Win the Future, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, which is named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas about what's actually working in the quickly changing field of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com, which is also where you can sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. And marketingbookpodcast.com is also where you can send me a message with any comments, suggestions, or recommendations for the show. I love hearing from listeners like you from around the world. I'm also on Twitter. My Twitter handle is marketingbook, or connect with me on LinkedIn. My name again is Douglas Burdett. I respond to every single message I get from listeners, so please introduce yourself. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome Rohit Bhargava back to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his newest book, Non-Obvious 2018 Edition, How to Predict Trends and Win the Future. Rohit Bhargava is a trend curator, marketing expert, storyteller, and the Wall Street Journal best-selling author of 5 books on topics as wide-ranging as the future of business and why leaders never eat cauliflower. Rohit is the founder of the Non-Obvious Company. He teaches marketing at Georgetown University, Go Hoyas, and has been invited to speak in 32 countries around the world. Prior to becoming an entrepreneur, Rohit spent 15 years leading brand strategy at 2 of the largest marketing agencies in the world, Ogilvy and Leo Burnett. Rohit, congratulations on Non-Obvious 2018, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you. It's awesome to be back.
So, Rohit, let's just start with a little bit about food and drink. Why do leaders not eat cauliflower?
Well, it's a little bit of a misnomer because I don't think humans should eat cauliflower. I mean, it's just disgusting. But my reason for that and that whole tangent was because I used to kind of keep it secret that I disliked cauliflower. And as soon as I started admitting it, it kind of gave me a way of being more vulnerable with people in a silly, small, tiny way. And people appreciated that and they remembered it because it was so weird and so quirky. And so the lesson I took from that when I was leading teams was let people inside, you know, be a little quirky, be a little vulnerable.
Right, right. And I really am not a big fan of Brussels sprouts, so I may, you know, start to go in that direction as well. It's like you've allowed me to, you know, to announce that. Now,
you know, my cauliphobia has become more relevant recently because cauliflower is having its day right now, which is great for me.
Well, that's about the food, but a careful reader of your book will learn that there is a drink named after you called the Rojito.
Yeah, it's easy to have a drink named after you if you name it yourself.
And that is a raspberry mojito?
Yeah, it was a joke that we had at the launch party for the first book edition of Non-Obvious. We created a signature drink and my name fit perfectly with it, so we went with it.
Well, now, whenever I hear about mojitos or cauliflower, you're going to occupy at least those parts of my consciousness.
That's my brand dominance right there.
That's right. That's right. So let me start with an excerpt and then we can get into the book. The simple aim of this book is to teach you how to notice the things that others miss. I call this non-obvious thinking, and learning to do it for yourself can change your business and your career. The context within which I'll talk about this type of thinking is business trends. For better or worse, most of us are fascinated by trends in those who predict them. We anticipate these predictions as a glimpse into the future, and they capture our imagination. There's only one problem. Too many trends are based on guesswork or lazy thinking. In other words, they are obvious instead of not obvious. This book was inspired by the landslide of obvious ideas we are surrounded with and our desire to do something better with them. In a world where everyone is one click away from being a self-declared expert, learning to think differently is more important than ever. Observing and curating ideas can lead to a unique understanding of why people choose to buy, sell, or believe anything. So the book, for the listener's benefit, is organized into four parts. And the first part explains this fantastic method you have where you spend an entire year or more curating the trends. And then part two is the 15 new ideas. And those are broken out into sections under like culture and consumer behavior, marketing and social media, media and education, technology and design, and finally economics and entrepreneurship. And then the third part is on how to actually make these trends actionable for you. And then what's also very interesting to me is part four, you review your 105 previously predicted trends for the past 7 years. That is some serious accountability. Well, I want to ask you to briefly explain how you do go about curating these trends, which is basically nonstop all year.
Yeah, it's nonstop, but essentially what it comes down to is collecting ideas, which I think we all in some way do. The difference between how I do it and how a lot of people do it is I have a system that I've come up with to help me make sense of those ideas when I look at them 9 months after I saved them. And that's, I think, what a lot of people are missing, because you go to a conference, for example, and you write down something you found interesting, and then 2 weeks later, you look at those notes, and if you can read them, you don't remember why you wrote it down in the first place. And so one of the first things I try and teach people when I go into groups of leaders and marketers is, how do you not lose your best ideas? Because that's the modern tragedy here, right? Like, that we're coming up with this amazing, awesome stuff, and the world is telling us to have more ideas, and we're going to conferences about how to be more creative. And then we come up with stuff, and then we forget about it 2 months later or 2 weeks later or 2 days later maybe. And so for me, this whole idea of curation is, the more information you collect, the more ideas you collect, the more you can then sit down at a certain point. And for me, it happens to be kind of, you know, 9 months later in the year, because I do this every year, and make the connections, make the intersections. And that's where new ideas come from. They don't come from within a particular industry. You can't be in financial services and come up with innovative ideas by only going to financial services resources. You have to look outside your industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rohit, explain why most trend predictions are, as you say, spectacularly useless.
Because most of the time, and we're at a good time right now, because, you know, anytime you have kind of a change of year, everybody starts writing these trend predictions, and you'll read these posts, articles, blog posts, and they'll say, you know, the hot trend for 2018 will be, you know, that social media will continue to grow, or that, you know, 3D printing or live video or live casting, right? Uh-huh. Or artificial intelligence, right? Which is my personal favorite right now. Like, artificial intelligence is not a trend. That's something that exists. And so a trend has to be directional. It has to actually tell you about something that's happening because of something that exists. And that's, I think, where a lot of these trends are just lazy, because they're just describing something that exists that's maybe going to grow. And that's not really that useful.
Is that why you say also that many trend predictions and are very self-indulgent?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I had a company that was all about self-driven cars, I sure as hell would predict that a trend for 2018 would be the rise of self-driven cars, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes sense for me. And so one of the things that I spend a lot of time with my team doing is trying to remove that sort of bias from the predictions that we have. We're not coming up with this stuff based on nothing that's already there. We're coming up with each one of these trends as a way of describing something that we usually have 40 or 50 stories and examples of through the research.
What then makes for a non-obvious trend?
There's a couple of things I look for. I mean, one is, it's got to be across industries. It can't just be happening in any one particular industry. The second thing I look for is it changing what we believe, how we act? Is it having an impact in either how we buy things as consumers or in how we market things as brands and businesses? If it's not having a sort of impact, then it's also not a trend. And the last thing I look for is it going to accelerate? Is it going to matter more for more people? Is it going to have more of an impact financially on companies, on organizations? Is it going to change the way we think about our careers? And if I find all of those things, then it becomes one of the trends.
Mm-hmm. Now, do new trends make old trends less relevant?
That's what a lot of people think. And what I've found over time is that a trend will either continue to accelerate or it won't. And over time, if a trend is well predicted, it may become obvious instead of non-obvious, but it doesn't go away. So new trends don't tend to replace old trends, although sometimes you'll see an evolution of how something's actually started versus how it starts to go.
And you've brought some trends back that you had talked about in previous editions, isn't that right?
Yeah, so I used to come up with 15 new trends every year. And if you can imagine, I mean, you know, rewriting about 40% of the same book every year is not a small amount of work. And what I was realizing was that a lot of the trends that were predicted in the past would kind of get buried, kind of like the older blog posts on a blog, because everybody just sees the newest thing. And over, I was going into these meetings and workshops, and people were really responding to these quote-unquote old predictions. And so what I started to do a couple years ago was five of the 15 trend predictions are previous predictions that have now been brought back. And when I bring them back, I talk about, and we do a lot of research with my team around how they've evolved from when they were first predicted to how they are now. And then we bring them back. And we never bring back a trend that was from the exact previous year. So in the 2018 edition, none of the trends that are brought back would be from 2017. They would always be from a year before that, like any year before that.
Mm-hmm. So just one more thing I want to arm the listener with as they become a more discerning observer of trends. Can you explain what future babble is and how to avoid that?
Yeah, so future babble is not my term. It's a term that a number of authors and people have used out there. And it is basically what we often hear from so-called experts, where they try and put some pieces together and say, this is what's going to happen 10 years from now and 15 years from now. And babble is used very intentionally because it really does speak to the idea that these are just guesses. And, you know, one of the things I say in the book is, you know, even a year or two before Twitter came out, nobody was really predicting what that would be. And that was just a year or two. And so the horizon for this report every year is the next year. And we do that very intentionally because the signs of what's going to matter in the next year, I believe, are already here. Whereas, you know, something that really takes off 3-4 years from now, you know, that could come from somewhere totally unexpected.
Mm-hmm. You know, for me, as just one reader, as I read through the book, it's almost like you're shining a light on certain things that I might have been somewhat aware of, but it clarifies it. So in other words, all the different trends, you'll talk about it, you explain it, you give examples, and then I immediately start drawing on other things that it makes me think of, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think what any writer would want. Look, I have so many stories that I wasn't able to put in the book just because you can't put everything in there. And I know that anytime you introduce something like a trend, I mean, the way I think of trends is really like a spark that starts the fire, right? And so that's how we use it. Like when I go into a workshop, I don't say, this is the trend and you have to make your entire business about this trend. I say, here's the trend. What ideas does that spark for what you could do differently? And that, I think, is kind of that thought process that you're describing.
Yeah, it's said even more inarticulately. It's like each chapter, I would say to myself, oh, yeah, I have seen that. I just didn't realize that it was, you know, maybe a trend. I guess it was your book helps to separate the, you know, the signal from the noise, so to speak. Well, let's talk about just a few of them that really jumped out at me, and I think would be very helpful for anyone that's in marketing and or sales. Let's start with the first one, truthing. Let me just read from the beginning of that chapter. As a consequence of eroding trust in media and institutions, people are engaging in a personal quest for the truth based on direct observation and face-to-face interaction. So I saw this, and one of the things that came to mind was fake news or whatever that is. It's constant discussion of that.
Yep.
Related?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this whole trend was probably mostly inspired by the rise of fake news. But it doesn't so much describe, like, this is where we get from obvious to non-obvious, right? I mean, it would be easy for anyone to say, well, fake news is the trend.
Right, yeah.
But that's actually not the trend. I mean, fake news exists. The trend is, like, what is our response to it? And
right,
what
right.
this trend describes is as consumers of media, our response increasingly is to look inward. And that's good and bad, you know, because we trust in the experiences that we have. So when we meet someone or we hear from someone who we know or that we've interacted with in person, we trust those interactions, which is the upside. The downside is that in a world where we can't trust the media that is coming at us, we retreat into our own worldview, which makes us more opinionated towards ourselves, right? So our point of view is correct. Other people's point of view of the world is incorrect. They must be idiots because they don't think the way that I think. And we're seeing so many signs of that. And so truthing is, like with many of my trends, it's not necessarily good or bad. It's describing the world the way it's happening right now. And so the question is, what do we do with this? What do we do with the knowledge that this is what's happening?
Yeah, it brought to mind just very suspicious consumers out there who are they don't believe. I'm wondering if maybe, you know, if you look at what consumers believe in, advertising is one of the lowest things on that scale, and one of the highest things is the opinions of their friends and family, like you mentioned, direct interactions. And this made me think that this clearly is a supporting element of the rise of what some are calling influencer marketing, where you're trying to push recommendations from people who are known to a certain audience.
Yeah, I think it is that natural response of, well, I'm going to trust those people who I kind of feel like I know. I mean, it also explains to some degree the popularity of cable news, some cable news hosts like John Oliver, or the popularity of email newsletters like The Skim, which have a very personality-driven take on how they curate the news. Personality-driven, which means I associate with this newsletter, which is just a bunch of text in my email inbox, but I associate with it because I know who's behind it in terms of their stories.
Mm-hmm. And it's becoming increasingly easier to find out who is behind certain things.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes not so much, right? Which is part of the challenge that Google and Facebook and all of those guys are having, which is some of these things are very difficult to track in terms of what's a verified source, where's it coming from, who's behind it, because the guys who are setting it up are pretty clever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's go to another one, enlightened consumption. And on this one, you say a lack of transparency and ethical lapses have led to millions of dollars in lost revenue and market share for brands that have not been able to grasp the power of today's enlightened consumers. So enlightened consumption, in there you talk about, you know, B2B supply chain transparency is more important now than ever. And it just brought to mind, you know, stories about who's actually making the Apple iPhone, who is actually making Nike's products overseas.
Yeah, it's, you know, it is powering, you know, what's interesting about this trend is when you say the word consumption in a trend, the first thing people tend to think about is consumers, right? And consumers are using these apps. I call them, you know, app-lightenment, right? Like they're using these apps to be able to instantly scan a barcode and see how a product was made or where the coffee was sourced from. And that is one form of enlightened consumption. But what was fascinating was I was starting to find more and more stories of B2B supply chain and vendors doing business in sustainable ways and businesses responding to that all the way down their supply chain. So you've got like a brand like Stony Creek Colors, which is a maker of colored dyes that are used for making blue jeans blue. And that's usually a very chemical driven process. But now you've got this one company out of, I think, Tennessee that's making this dye out of indigo plants and sourcing them from farmers who used to raise tobacco and now farm indigo plants to make this blue dye. Mm-hmm. And so there's this whole like beautiful ecosystem around a story like that where you think, oh, well, I'm not as a consumer buying blue dye for my jeans, right? That's bought by the company, but it's part of that whole ecosystem. And so it's really transcending consumption from consumers and being consumption from consumers and from businesses, which was really interesting. I didn't expect that when we first went into digging into this.
It brought to mind also a lot of the coffee companies will talk quite a bit about exactly where their beans are grown and the relationship they have with the growers.
Yeah, it is. And yes, technology enables that because now I can see that. But, you know, that's been around for a long time. I think what's new and what's different here is that this enlightenment has become a signature statement about ourselves in much more of a visible way than it ever was in the past. So it was kind of like, it used to be sort of like the recycling, you know, like, you know, you should do it and you try your best and you hope that it's doing something. But now it's kind of becoming like that badge we wear on our arms to say, like, I'm a consumer of this product. I believe in this way of doing business. And that's my public persona. That's who I am.
Right. And I think the message for a lot of the companies out there is, are you giving your customers something to believe in?
Right. I mean, and there's all sorts of follow-ons that lead from that, right? I mean, if you have true loyalty and not just passive loyalty, which was one of the trends from last year, then you have to be able to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, another of your trends here, it brought to mind another book that was on the Marketing Book Podcast a few, maybe 2 years ago, by Martin Lindstrom called Small Data, where he talked about how marketers and companies are over-relying on big data, and I'm going to use an expression that Mr. Ogilvy popularized. They use data like a drunk uses a streetlight, more for support than for illumination.
Yeah, I love that quote. Ogilvy's got some great ones.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, Martin's book was excellent because it's, I mean, first of all, it just gave you a window into, if you know anything about his story, I mean, he has a fascinating way of just basically going and living in consumers' homes and then observing what they do. And so he sees things that you or I would probably never see unless we went and lived inside somebody else's home. And so his insights are really from there. And it was interesting because his book, Small Data, came out maybe 4 or 5 months after I had published the 2015 non-obvious report. And one of the trends in that report was small data. But the way I had described it was a little bit differently. So he was saying, you know, small data is this sort of firsthand observational data. And the way that I was talking about it was that big data was data collected by companies, and small data, in my description of it, was the data that we're collecting about ourselves. Or that we have ownership of. So like your Fitbit data, or the fact that you can take back your Facebook data, and how important this data was increasingly becoming, because if the regulation continues to allow you to access your own data, which currently it mostly does, and hopefully it will continue to, there's some really interesting implications around, okay, if I can control my own data and I can take it from one place to another, then I can monetize my own data. Really a big shift.
So in this one called Over-Targeting, you say, lured by the promise of big data, organizations segment audiences too narrowly and unintentionally end up abandoning large groups of potentially lucrative customers. That was a big surprise for me. Can you say more about the mistake that companies are making by trying to target too narrowly?
Yeah, I mean, the example I used was really powerful for me because it got me thinking about this was me having to go to a formal event and wanting to wear not just your obvious black bow tie. One of the problems of writing a book called Non-Obvious is it gets into your head and then you're like, oh man, I need to have a different bow tie. And so I went online and searched for bow ties for this event. And I'm not a bow tie kind of guy. I don't wear ties really. Definitely not bow ties usually.
Hey, go easy on the bow tie wearers.
Hey, it's kidding. You know, if you can pull off a bow tie, you know, it's great.
Well, you do live in Virginia, so.
I know. I live in the D.C. area, which is probably has a higher bow tie wearing population than most places, I would guess.
All right.
But I went online, searched for this this bow tie, ended up not buying one because it wouldn't arrive in time. And so I went to a store and I bought one for my event. And for the next 3 weeks, I wrote a blog post about how these bow tie ads just followed me around everywhere. They were the term I used to describe it was they were adverse stalking me, continuing to try and retarget me and sell me a bow tie, not knowing that A, I had purchased a bow tie, and B, I wasn't really a bow tie consumer, even though I happened to have searched for a bow tie once.
So what should they have done?
Well, in this case, you know, the problem is all of their numbers tell them that they did exactly what they should have done, right? I mean, I was a consumer. I put a bow tie into a shopping cart. I didn't check out. And so for the next few weeks, of course, the next thing they're going to try and do is get me back to that shopping cart to check out. The problem is there's no data that allows them to know that I'm not their consumer, or at least I'm not their consumer for that particular product. And so maybe they should try and sell me something else. Now, the issue is not so much that that's how they did it. The issue is that they'll never know that that didn't work because of the fact that it was bad targeting. And so sometimes they'll go back and look at those numbers and they'll say, well, maybe we just didn't spend enough doing the same dumb thing. And that is a problem that is going across so much of digital marketing right now, which is we're just spending. And when we don't see the results we want, we're getting the message that, oh, well, we didn't spend enough. We didn't target as highly. We didn't pay enough per click. And that was a problem. Yeah. And I think that's just flawed thinking.
Well, let's talk about another one that kind of worries me. And that's the brand stand. And you say, reacting to a polarized media atmosphere, more brands feel compelled to take a stand and highlight their core values rather than try to be all things to all people. And what has me worried there is, do you think they should do more of that? Or are they risking alienating people by taking stands that will turn off, you know, people before they would have ever considered them?
Well, the point is they are risking alienating people, and that's kind of the point of taking a stand, right? I mean, it's not really an effective stand if you're not standing for something. And I think what this trend is describing is that companies who would have never imagined doing that ever on any issue are finding that in this media climate, they can do it and get away with it. And that is different because if you've ever worked in PR or any sort of crisis communications, I mean, one of the basics that you always tell a brand is never, ever take a stand where you're going to alienate people. Never, right? Mm-hmm. And yet you think about enlightened consumption and how we go for companies that believe the things that we believe. You think about how there are things that are universally almost believed in by the population of America, even though our politics don't reflect it. And it's a safer environment for brands to take a stand. And if they lose consumers, then they lose some consumers. But the net positive consumers they gain outweighs that, especially in a world where you have so much parity across a particular brand or a particular sector where people are looking for a reason to kind of have something stand apart from something else.
Yeah, I guess I couldn't help but think of the companies that take a political stand, and that's not the only thing you're talking about here. They could be taking a stand in support of something they feel strongly about, maybe not necessarily political.
Well, and you know, the line is tough, right? I mean, the one way of thinking of a political stand is the brand telling you who to vote for, right? Which is one way of thinking of a political stand. But another is, you know, does the brand welcome immigrants? You know, and is welcoming immigrants a political stand? Or is it just inclusive that what anybody should do, right? And so like that's the sort of gray area that we're in now where a brand could say something like, yeah, we believe all people are equal. Well, is that really a political stand? Maybe it's kind of become one because of the way politics are now, but inherently it's not.
So another one that – just two others I wanted to ask you about. One of them is backstory telling. And this is very interesting because it can also work for brand new companies. So you say organizations use the power of stories to share their heritage, mission, and reason for existing with audiences to earn loyalty and position themselves as desirable places to work. So can you explain what backstory telling is?
Yeah, it is this idea that rather than just saying, I mean, it'd be easy to say, oh, everybody is a storyteller now, right?
Well, marketing is. Yeah, I certainly hear that a lot. I think it's very misunderstood too.
It is, you know, because we kind of put this pressure on ourselves to be like filmmakers. And there are many ways to tell a story. And the point of telling stories, I believe, is to have some sort of emotional engagement. And I think without the people, without the characters, like you don't have the emotional engagement. And so backstory telling is a very specific trend where organizations are looking back into their histories, whether their histories happen to be 100 years or, you know, just a couple of months, and saying, look, the more of a lens we can put on the way we got to where we are, the more reasons people have for believing in us. And so let's tell that story. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Again, it gives somebody something to a consumer, something to believe in and identify with on a deeper level than just talking about your products or your services.
Yeah, that's right. And it's also, you know, it has the benefit of being less fabricated because, you know, if you have to come up with a product story for, you know, wine glasses, maybe you can. Maybe you're kind of making some stuff up because you don't have the story, right? I mean, you just developed a glass and you tested it and people liked it and so you sold it. Okay. But companies are a little different. Like the way companies come about, who starts them, how do they get to be where they are, what the difficulties they've had. I mean, that's a much more human story.
Yeah. The next one I want to ask you about has already had an effect on me since I read about it, and it's called manipulated outrage. And I learned about this and started to make me actually a little bit angry that I was being manipulated, but I've stopped listening to as much news on the radio or podcasts. I don't have cable or satellite TV at home, so I don't have to watch it. But I've seen it. I know exactly, or I think I had a very good idea of how this is working. And you say, media, data analytics, and advertising are combining forces to create a perpetual stream of noise that is intended to incite rage and elicit angry reactions on social media and in real life. And of course, I naturally thought of, at least in the United States, of some of these different cable news networks that have a particular, you know, political slant. And it seems like they're just trying to incite rage and elicit angry reactions.
Yeah, the problem is that anger is a deep emotion that causes us to care. And, you know, the alternative is indifference. And a lot of times, like the regular non-rage inciting stories, they create some indifference. People just don't really care that much. Mm-hmm. And so on some level, and I'm not trying to, you know, take away blame from the media culture that's creating the outrage, but yeah, at the end of the day, like we're the ones supplying the outrage. And so, you know, what you just said really is the solution. If we stop rewarding those things that are intending to make us angry with our eyeballs and our attention and our commenting and our furious sharing, then that stuff starts to go away.
Mm-hmm. Now, we both live in Virginia, and we recently had an election for governor and other offices. And I was reminded of course, it's like any of these campaigns where one side tries to make the other, you know, just look absolutely awful. I mean, you know, like one candidate wants everyone to think the other's a meth dealer, and you know, the other one wants you to think they're a pedophile or something like, just, you know, awful. And I remember hearing about studies that have been done where they show that people will actually are more inclined to vote against something than they are to vote for a candidate. And again, the manipulated outrage just came to mind, and it just reminded me of so much of the current political situation, at least here in the U.S. So.
Yeah, it's the idea that, you know, people are more motivated by fear than by hope. And the other thing, you know, to quote our friend David Ogilvy, who about political advertising said that it should not be allowed because it's really the only form of truly dishonest advertising out there. Yeah. And I think that's true.
Yeah. And I think the more informed the voters are, the worse it is for a candidate.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, the funny thing is I uncovered a quote that I actually talk about in the book that pointed out, and I never really thought about this before, but it pointed out that being more informed about your own point of view doesn't necessarily make you more knowledgeable. It just makes you more opinionated.
Right. Well, I know that I said that was the last one, but I just want to ask one other because it seems like it has a lot of applications for marketers, and that is this light speed learning. And you say the road to mastery on any topic gets faster through the help of bite-sized learning modules that make education more time efficient, engaging, useful, and fun. Please explain.
Yeah, I mean, I think we see signs of this when it comes to learning and how there's so many different platforms for learning that are out there that allow us to get new skills and get them quickly. I think we see it in terms of the growth of e-learning and open online courses and online universities even. So there's plenty of signs of this. I think what's new and what's interesting is that what used to be two different things, which was online learning, and then there was like kind of the hacking of stuff, like hacking language learning. So you could like learn a language in like 3 weeks, or, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And now like it's all kind of being combined with these like tasty videos, right? Which we see on online, where you can like learn how to cook like a certain pasta bake dish with like a bunch of different images in a 30-second video. And so like all of these are signs of this idea that learning how to do anything is on demand. And I see it with my kids, right, in terms of how they teach themselves to do new things. And there was a story that I actually wrote about in this chapter of I think it was like an 8-year-old who taught himself how to drive because he wanted to go and get a McDonald's hamburger through the drive-thru, and he was hungry. And he took the car and he went to the drive-thru, and then the people working at the drive-thru thought they were being pranked, and when they figured out they weren't, they called the police, and the police called his parents, and then the kid was crying because he realized he did something wrong. And basically, the policeman, when they interviewed him afterwards, he was like, yeah, the kid just went on YouTube, learned how to drive, and went to get a burger. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's what we have.
The application here that jumped in my mind was that of, rather than trying, it is released to content marketing, rather than trying to necessarily provide a massive ebook or something like that, it brought to mind the idea of like an email course where they'll send you something every day for 2 weeks, where they break it down into more manageable chunks. Is that at all similar?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot of people using this trend to generate revenue. And especially in the world that you're talking about, I think some are good, some are, you know, totally not worth it. But the point is, like, this is how people are increasingly learning these new skills and new tactics. And so that's not going away anytime soon. I mean, it's growing hugely. But I think that what's having an impact on us, more than just the fact that this stuff is available, is our expectation that now we can learn these new things much more quickly than we ever could before. Mm-hmm.
So, Rohit, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I think it's that the non-obvious details of the world only come when you look outside of your blinders, outside of the media that you typically consume, outside of the things in your industry that you see most often. Mm-hmm. And so we have to be intentional about doing that. And so if there's one thing I hope people take away, it's be curious and be intentional about what you read and what you pay attention to.
Yes, be intentional about your media diet.
Yeah, that's right.
So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
You know, one that I just read actually illustrates this point, I think, pretty well. It's by the guy who writes the Dilbert comic strip in his new book, which is called Win Bigly.
Oh,
and he got, he got a lot of criticism because he was one of the unexpected people who was behind Trump from the very beginning. And in his book, he explains how Trump is a master persuader, and how he manages to be persuasive. And he really kind of digs into what makes Trump effective. And I found it fascinating because, you know, I don't tend to read that much about, you know, why Trump is successful. I don't think there's that much good commentary about it. I think there's just, you know, totally biased, opinionated stuff on either end. But this helps me to understand a different perspective about him and about the tools of persuasion that he's using, some of them manipulating outrage for his benefit. And it made me, I think, a little smarter about what is out there and how perhaps not to get manipulated myself quite so easily.
Interesting. Yeah, I always find politics and the political world, which I'm not in, to be interesting in so much as how they are marketing themselves. Sort of like a war brings about advancements in the medical area. Politics brings about advancements and deep examination of how different candidates are marketing themselves. And before the 2016 election in the U.S., David Merriman Scott did quite a few articles about the marketing aspects of all the different candidates, which was really fascinating. So how best can listeners learn more about you and your book?
The best way is just to go to my website, which is just my name, rohitbhargava.com. And you'll find lots of materials there. Or you can get a excerpt and download form of the book if you go to nonobviousbook.com/2018.
Okay. And we'll make sure to include links to those in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. The name of the book is Non-Obvious 2018 Edition, How to Predict Trends and Win the Future. The author is Rohit Bhargava. Rohit, thank you very much for being on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you.
And that closes the book on episode 156 of the Marketing Book Podcast. Links to everything linkable in the interview you just listened to are at marketingbookpodcast.com. And that's also where you can sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. And if you have any feedback on or suggestions to improve the show, or perhaps if I can make a book recommendation, I would love to hear from you. Just go to marketingbookpodcast.com and leave me a message or tweet at me. My Twitter handle is marketingbook. Or do what lots of listeners do and connect with me on LinkedIn. My name again is Douglas Burdett. And please join us next time as we welcome Daryl Weber to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, Brand Seduction, How Neuroscience Can Help Marketers Build Memorable Brands. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
percent of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.